The Katra Podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge, simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Katra AI. Welcome back to the deep dive. You know, we've all heard it, right? That magic number, 10,000 hours.
Oh yeah, the idea that if you just put in the time, you can become world-class at anything.
Exactly. It's really appealing. Effort equals success. Simple.
It is appealing. maybe a little too simple sometimes, especially when we start talking about sports. And that's what we're diving into today with David Epstein's book, The Sports Gene: Inside the Science of Extraordinary Athletic Performance.
Right. So our mission today really is to unpack this whole nature versus nurture thing in athletics. Is it all about grit and practice, or, you know, did some people just hit the genetic jackpot?
Or more likely, how do those two things actually work together?
Yeah.
Because that's the core question, isn't it?
It is. And it matters because that 10,000-hour idea, it's everywhere. But Epstein's work really pushes back on it, especially in sports, saying, hang on, biology matters a lot.
Absolutely. Mm. He forces us to look at the biological hardware, as he calls it. It's not a blank slate you just program with practice. So yeah, we're going to get into the science, the stories, see where that line between hard work and, well, innate advantage really lies.
Okay, sounds good. So before we jump into the genes and the training, maybe let's talk about the author, David Epstein. What makes him the right guy to tackle this?
Well, he's got this really interesting background that puts him right at the crossroads of sports journalism and science.
Okay.
When he wrote the book, he was a senior writer at Sports Illustrated. And so, you know, incredible access. He's talking to top athletes, coaches, seeing training firsthand, getting the inside scoop, basically.
Like the real world stuff.
Exactly. But he's not just a sports writer. He also has a master's degree in environmental science. So he actually understands the research. He can read the genetic studies and, you know, make sense of them.
That's a pretty crucial combination.
It is. And maybe just as importantly, he was a competitive runner himself in college at Columbia. So he gets the athlete's perspective, too.
Ah, okay. So he's lived it. He's reported on it, and he understands the science behind it. He's kind of a bridge builder between the lab and the field.
That's a great way to put it. A synthesizer. He weaves together the genetic research, these complex scientific ideas, with really compelling human stories from the world of sports. That synthesis is what makes his perspective so powerful, I think.
Okay, so he's got the credentials. What's the main argument he's building in the sports gene? What's the core idea?
The central premise is pretty clear. Elite performance isn't just nature or just nurture. It's always both. It's a complex interplay. And he actually uses the word multiplicative.
Multiplicative, meaning?
Meaning like talent times practice equals skill. If either your talent or your practice is zero or close to it, the outcome is going to be zero too. It's not additive. You can't just make up for a total lack of innate ability with sheer hours.
Ah, okay. I like that. And he uses an analogy, right? The hardware and software thing.
Yeah. That's maybe the most helpful way to think about it. Your genes, your biology, that's the hardware. Your body type, muscle fiber types, lung capacity, all that stuff. It's the potential you're born with.
Your blueprint.
Exactly. Your blueprint. And then deliberate practice, the training, the strategy, the skill development, that's the software you load onto that hardware.
Okay.
But here's the key. The best software in the world won't run well on hardware that just isn't suited for the task.
Right.
You can't run complex video editing software on a 10-year-old basic laptop.
Right. So your training software can only take you as far as your genetic hardware allows.
Pretty much. There are limits. So the book's goal really is to move past those kind of simplistic myths, like the 10,000-hour rule being this universal key, and offer a more scientifically grounded view. Success in sports isn't one size fits all. It's about that specific mix of genes and environment.
Okay, let's go into the specifics then. He uses some really striking examples to illustrate this, doesn't he? How does he frame the debate early on?
He starts with a fantastic contrast. Two high jumpers. Right. Really sets the stage.
Right, I remember this one. Stefan Holm.
Stefan Holm the Swede. He was like the embodiment of practice. Trained meticulously for decades, perfected his technique, became an Olympic champion. He's the 10,000-hour guy, the poster child for dedication.
The ultimate software optimizer.
Totally. Then you have Donald Thomas from the Bahamas.
And his story is different.
Yeah, wildly different. He basically started high jumping, and just 8 months later, he wins the world championship.
8 months? How?
He had almost no technique. But he possessed this incredibly long Achilles tendon. like freakishly long. It acts like a giant biological spring. So his raw physical gift, his hardware, just catapulted him to the top almost instantly.
Wow. That really throws the practices everything idea out the window, doesn't it?
It certainly complicates it. It shows that, yeah, dedication is huge, but sometimes an extraordinary physical gift can, let's say, shorten the path considerably.
But Epstein doesn't just leave it there saying it's all genetics, right? He balances it.
No, definitely not. He brings in examples like Jenny Finch, the softball pitcher.
Striking out Major League Baseball players.
Right. Even though her pitch was technically slower than what they normally see, her success wasn't about raw power, the physical metric. It was the specifics of her underhand delivery, the weird trajectory. It messed with their timing.
So highly specialized software in that case.
Exactly. It shows that specific adaptations, often developed through years of practice, can absolutely trump raw physical attributes in the right context.
Okay, so it's always this interplay, which brings us back to that 10,000-hour rule. Epstein takes a closer look at where that idea even came from.
He does. He goes back to the original study by Anders Ericsson, the one with the violinists in Germany. And he points out something crucial. 10,000 hours wasn't some magic threshold anyone could cross to become elite. It was simply the average number of practice hours among musicians who were already considered elite.
So it described the path of people already at the top. It didn't prescribe a path to the top for anyone.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And applying it broadly to sports ignores the, well, the non-negotiable physical prerequisites. Like you said earlier, you can practice basketball forever, but if you're 5 feet tall,
your chances in the NBA are kind of slim.
Kind of slim, yeah. Your innate traits, your hardware, they define your starting point, and they also influence how quickly you improve with practice.
This leads into his point about body types in sports, right? The big bang of specialized physiques.
Yeah, anthropometry, the study of human body measurements. He shows how modern sports have become incredibly effective at sorting people by body type. It's like natural selection, but for sports.
How so?
Well, elite athletes aren't just fitter than average people anymore. Their body shapes are becoming more and more extreme, more different from the general population.
Yeah, an example.
Think swimmers. Michael Phelps is the classic case. Super long torso, relatively short legs, massive arm span like an albatross. That shape is incredibly efficient for swimming. Or elite gymnasts. They tend to be very short, compact, great for leverage and rotation.
And he argues this isn't the training making them that way.
No, it's the other way around. The sports themselves select for people who already have those genetic predispositions. If you don't have that swimmer's body, you're probably not going to reach the absolute elite level no matter how hard you train. It's a genetic sorting mechanism.
It makes you realize professional sports are populated by, well, outliers, physically speaking.
Total outliers.
Yeah.
It's not a realm for the genetically average anymore.
Okay, so if body type is the visible hardware, what about the stuff we can't see, the actual genes?
Right, he gets into specific genes too. The most famous one is probably ACTN3, sometimes called the sprint gene.
Mm.
It's linked to the production of a protein found in fast twitch muscle fibers, the ones you need for explosive power. And guess what? It's found in unusually high frequencies among elite sprinters, particularly Jamaicans.
So it's not the only factor, but it's a significant piece of the puzzle for sprinting success.
A very significant piece. But then there are even more extreme cases where genetics seems almost decisive, like Iiromen Tarranta.
The Finnish skier from the 60s.
Yeah, an absolute legend. Turns out he had this rare genetic mutation. His body naturally produced way more red blood cells than normal.
So like natural blood doping.
Essentially, yes. Lifelong built-in blood doping. He had this massive advantage in oxygen carrying capacity. No amount of training could let his competitors match that fundamental biological edge. It's kind of staggering.
It really is. It shows that sometimes genetics can be the single biggest factor. But you said maybe the most important insight for like regular people is this idea of trainability.
Yes. This is huge and maybe a little controversial. The core idea is it's not just your baseline talent that's genetic. Your actual capacity to improve with training is also heavily influenced by your genes.
Wait, so how much benefit I get from the same workout as someone else could be different because of our genes?
Exactly. He points to studies like the Heritage Family Study. They put lots of people on the exact same standardized exercise program.
And the results?
All over the map. Some people, the high responders, saw huge improvements in things like VO2 max or strength. Others, the low responders, doing the identical workouts, saw very little change, sometimes almost none.
Wow. Okay, that changes things. Because we tend to think if you're not getting results, you're just not trying hard enough.
Right. It removes some of that moral judgment. It's not necessarily a failure of willpower if a specific training plan isn't working wonders for you. It might just be a mismatch between the software, the training, and your specific genetic hardware. Your body isn't wired to respond strongly to that particular stimulus.
So it's about finding the right kind of training for your genes. Personalization.
Precisely. Low responders might need a totally different approach or maybe just a lot more work to get the same gains as a high responder.
Which kind of leads us to the Kalenjin runners in Kenya, doesn't it? The ultimate example of everything coming together.
The perfect storm, yeah. Their dominance in distance running isn't down to just one thing.
It's multiple factors.
Right. There seems to be a genetic predisposition for a certain body type. Very slender limbs, particularly lower legs, which is super efficient for running. Less weight to swing.
The hardware.
But then you add the software and the environment. They often train at high altitude. There's a culture that absolutely reveres running and strong economic incentives to succeed in the sport.
Nature and nurture.
I see.
Hardware and software perfectly aligned. The multiplicative formula in action.
Couldn't have said it better myself. It's the ideal synergy.
Okay, so moving beyond these specific stories, what are the big overarching themes or messages we should take away from the book?
Well, the first one we've basically covered, that multiplicative formula. Talent times practice equals skill. You need both. You can't multiply by zero. Effort matters immensely, but it operates within the bounds set by your potential.
Right. And for elite levels, that potential, that talent ceiling is pretty critical. Does he suggest it matters less for just, you know, getting better at a hobby?
I think the implication is that for non-elite performance, effort and smart practice can take you a very long way. Absolutely. But even then, understanding your hardware helps. If you find you're a low responder to, say, endurance training, maybe focus your energy on strength training, where you might see better results. It's about playing to your strengths.
Makes sense. Okay, theme number two.
That has to be trainability as the genetic wild card. The idea that our ability to respond to training is itself genetic. This really challenges the comforting idea that pure grit conquers all. It adds this layer of biological reality.
Yeah, that one really sticks with you. And the third.
The third key theme is that cognitive talent is athletic talent. Genius in sports isn't just physical. The brain is absolutely crucial hardware and software.
Beyond just strategy and tactics, you mean?
Definitely. He talks about things like the quiet eye in elite shooters or archers. They visually lock onto the target for a measurably longer, steadier period right before they execute the shot. It's a cognitive skill.
Interesting.
Or think about baseball hitters facing a 95-mile-per-hour fastball. They don't consciously see the whole path of the ball. Their brains are processing visual cues incredibly rapidly, predicting the trajectory almost instantly. That's a kind of cognitive processing speed, a mental talent that's vital for athletic success at that level.
So the brain's processing power is part of the hardware package, too.
Absolutely. Specialized hardware and incredibly refined software working together.
Epstein has such a knack for boiling these big ideas down into memorable lines. Let's maybe share a few of those key quotes or takeaways.
Yeah, he does phrase things really well. I think maybe the best one encapsulating the whole nature-nurture balance is, your genome is not your destiny, but it is your starting point.
Oh, that's good. It acknowledges the genes without being totally deterministic.
Exactly. And then there's the direct challenge to the big myth. The 10,000-hour rule ignores innate talent, which determines how much you benefit from every hour of practice.
That just cuts right through it, doesn't it? Puts the focus back on the interaction.
It really does. And maybe the most practical piece of advice, the one that shifts the focus from just grinding away, is success is about finding the right pond for your particular fish.
So don't just bash your head against a wall trying to be a world-class marathoner if your body screams sprinter. Find the activity that fits you. Self-discovery over blind effort.
That's the gist of it. Align your natural strengths, your hardware, with the demands of the activity.
So thinking about practical applications, how can listeners use this? Maybe parents involved in youth sports.
Okay, yeah. For parents, this is a really strong argument against forcing kids into super early, intense specialization in just one sport.
Why is that?
Because you likely don't know what their innate strengths or hardware really are yet.
Yeah.
Epstein advocates for a sampling period when kids are younger. Let them try lots of different things, swimming, soccer, gymnastics, track, whatever.
So they can discover where they naturally click, find their pond.
Exactly. See where they show aptitude, where they improve quickly, where they actually enjoy it because things come a bit more naturally. And crucially, stop comparing kids unfairly. One kid might progress way faster than another in the same sport simply because of genetic differences in trainability, not because one is lazy and the other isn't.
That's a huge relief for a lot of parents and kids, I bet. Take some pressure off. What about for individuals, just on their own fitness journeys?
Understanding that low responder concept we talked about, that can be incredibly freeing.
How so?
Well, if you've been diligently following, say, a running plan for months, and you're just not seeing the fitness gains you expected, it might not be you. It might not be a lack of willpower. It could genuinely be that your genes aren't optimized for responding to that specific type of aerobic training.
So instead of beating yourself up, you should maybe switch things up.
Yeah. Try something different. Maybe high-intensity intervals work better for you. Maybe weightlifting is where your body is primed to make gains. It encourages self-awareness and personalization rather than just sticking blindly to a plan that isn't delivering for your specific biology.
Find the exercise pond for your fish.
You got it.
You know, reading this really gave me a much deeper appreciation for elite athletes. It's not just hard work.
Oh, absolutely. They are true outliers.
Yeah.
They needed the lucky genetic draw, the right hardware, and then they had to layer on years, decades of incredibly smart, dedicated practice. That multiplicative formula working at its absolute peak.
They won the lottery and then worked like crazy to cash the ticket.
That's a good way to put it. And it leads to a really interesting, maybe slightly uncomfortable thought to close on.
Okay.
If these huge genetic advantages play such a big role and they are fundamentally unearned, how does that make us think about fairness and meritocracy in sports? We love the idea that sports are the ultimate level playing field where hard work wins out.
But the sports gene suggests the field might not be quite as level as we like to think. The starting lines are staggered.
Exactly. Doesn't mean we don't celebrate the dedication, but it forces a more nuanced view. It complicates the simple story of merit. Something to chew on, definitely.
It certainly is a much more complex and maybe more accurate picture of human achievement. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.